Welcome to Constructing Mindsets, discussing the building blocks of our mental health. Today, we welcome Frederick Levy to share his experience of approaching a cliff edge and falling into depression, which was ultimately triggered by the extreme pressure he put himself to be the perfect father to his newborn son. We talk about the build-up of stress, the fear of failure, and coming out the other side with new perspectives. Welcome, Frederick.
Thanks, Anna. So, yeah, it's a great pleasure to be here. So I'll start with effectively what you mentioned was like the build-up of stress, which ultimately led to a depressive episode. So building up to that period of my life, in the space of 5 years before that, there was a lot of change, which I had only really appreciated after the episode happened. But just as an indication, in the space of 5 years, graduated from my doctorate degree, I had effectively moved jobs three times, moving up from my university where I did my doctorate, moving to Warwick, and then back down into Balham, actually, and then to Croydon as well. Bought a house, which is always an eventful time. Finished part-time MBA, which I'd started during my doctorate. Became a chartered engineer and got married and had a son. So that's quite a bit of change, I recognise, for anyone to go through. And the final, I guess, ramp up after all that change was then going on shared parental leave for 5 months, which was a new, relatively new government scheme around then, which allows the non-birth partner, let's say, to take a period of time off and take effectively the statutory maternity leave pay from the other partner. And I did that for about 5 months, and that was effectively like pouring kerosene onto effectively a smouldering bonfire of change that I'd gone through. And as I, looking at it retrospectively up into the episode, I kind of felt that I would have had a blindfold on, not appreciating how far I was going, like all the signs that I now recognize, like I had no idea. As I approached the cliff edge, I would have suicidal thoughts, not regularly, but effectively not address them. I'd swat them away and say, well, in reality, I've had these when I was younger. They're not important. I'd also get tinnitus, which is a ear ringing out of the blue, three to 5 minutes, at least maybe once a day, just something physical. Didn't really reach out to anyone. Also, intense agitation. So if you find you're completely restless, you can't really sit down and relax. Didn't really pay any attention to that. One I found quite strange was eating, spitting out food. So part of like, comfort eating, but then feeling guilt that you've sort of had that comfort. Ceased shaving and hadn't really had a haircut for about 2 or 3 months. And stressing about nap times, food times, any other structure you try and place on a five-month-old. So all of that was sort of wrapped up while looking after my son. I was pretty much with him, going to children's centres, meeting other parents for most of the day. And I think that falls under being completely wrapped up and trying to be this perfect father, cooking food from scratch. So I made goat curries, shepherd's pie, all the recipes I could lay my hand on to give him a diverse diet during his weaning phase. All the nap times, so you should be having a nap. Well, the book would say you have a nap for this amount of time. And so if that didn't happen, I'd see it as a failure. And also trying to stop him waking up at night. So the books would say the child should not be waking up at XYZ. Okay, I need to do something about this. And that also contributes, I guess, to sleep deprivation. So I think for a year, I think the longest stretch of sleep I had was about 4 hours. That was kind of the kerosene which got poured onto the smoking, smouldering change bonfire. And then the final ramp, which where my sort of mind decided it would take over my body, was that effectively I was packing for we're about to go on holiday, and I had to pack the car. So gonna pack a car. It's stressful. We're trying to work out where things go, what you should take, especially for a young child. It's your first driving holiday, and so a rational response is you ring your parents. Like, do you want to come help? Because my wife's at work. But after the call, I actually cried. I had a sobbing moment, and that I would class as probably an irrational response to effectively asking someone for help. Like, nowadays I wouldn't class asking someone for help. Like, why should they? There's an irrational response. Considering the way I ran my life at that point, didn't really, okay, I had a cry, right, get on with the next task, which was probably cleaning up. He was asleep, therefore I should go clean up and prepare for the next off, like the afternoon of activity. And then the depressed, like at 4 o'clock in the morning, what my psychiatrist eventually called was the depressive episode. I woke up screaming, shouting, sobbing uncontrollably, couldn't control my body. And that was it. That was my ground zero.
Wow. I mean, that's so much to happen to you. I mean, not only the build up to that, you had so many achievements in your life in terms of, graduating from your doctorate, moving into a new house, you know, finishing your part-time MBA, new job, chartered engineer, getting married. All these things are very stressful in themselves. And also, you know, they're big achievements in your life. And then I guess it was when your son came into your life, it was that a next thing that you wanted to put all your effort into, you know, be the perfect father for him as he was growing up. And I can't speak from experience, but I can imagine that it's an incredibly joyful time, but also probably incredibly overwhelming, regardless of any other stress factors that you may already be experiencing with work. From another parent's perspective, Lucy, you know, does this resonate with you, the sense of sort of being overwhelmed? And is there that really high pressure to be the perfect parent?
Yes, I mean, I've got two kids of my own, two under five and two stepdaughters as well. I think my first experience was very similar to what Frederick is describing there in terms of the pressures. Second was a very different, less tense experience. But what I would say in terms of, you know, pressure on parents, one aspect is the pressure's immediate from the moment you know you're going to be a parent. So kind of whatever kind of workaholic, alcoholic, binge eating, binge watching person you've been before, you're thinking, right, you know, from this moment, I'm going to be amazing at this, you know, and like any time that you set yourself up on an extreme diet or something like that and want to click that switch and say, right, I'm going to be great at this, I'm going to be different, and you can fail to meet your own high expectations. So secondly, I think there's then the pressure to get everything right after the birth. And, you know, if we were setting up a project that was like a keep baby alive for 6 months program of works, you know, I don't think we'd give it to two or possibly one staff member, disrupt their sleeping patterns, provide no training whatsoever, remove all their sources of enjoyment because we've occupied them 24/7. And then expect them to be our high performers, you know. But we don't have that conversation with parents. We don't say, I expect you to be crap at everything that you have done so far in your life. Just keep this baby alive and you'll be doing absolutely superbly. Doesn't matter whether it's goat curry, you know, or whatever you can come up with. Keep the baby alive and we're doing well. And then I think thirdly, you know, there's the fact that we're in a wildly changing landscape of parenting where we're having to find new ways of doing things for ourselves. So that like 1950s, how was work today, darling? You know, model of your stay-at-home mum and your working dad, that's long gone. And we haven't found our new model yet. And it's great that, you know, people like Frederick are at the forefront of doing that. So we're juggling and and I think also, you know, I've recently had people ask me, you know, how are you juggling everything so well? Because they think, you know, I'm doing my job and I'm doing homeschooling and I'm looking after a toddler. When the reality is I've got full-time help. You know, so imagine the pressure people are putting on themselves through comparisons like that, looking at somebody else's life and thinking I should be doing that, you know, without really understanding the support networks that they've got behind them. And then I think, you know, there's a whole other conversation about social media, accessibility, lack of privacy, you know, all that perfect life stuff that's just not helpful. But I am conscious of kind of, you know, that's probably my top three, and I want to stop there because some of you haven't had kids yet.
All of the fun to come.
So, you know. Yeah, but really, you know, really interested to hear from Frederick kind of how he got back up out of that and kind of how, what was that immediate aftermath of that moment like, you know, from that 4 o'clock in the morning piece there?
Yeah, thanks. So a lot of, and I appreciate on a podcast, a lot, I think your first statement around setting up a project really resonated in terms of we all like our little planning, but in reality, like if we're not, it's something that just comes out of the blue, and having that support network, which with the benefit of hindsight, I didn't have completely, it's so important. So anyone who's contemplating, like, reach out to parents, friends, and they're more than happily help and volunteer efforts to support. But yeah, going back to, I guess, the aftermath. So I was effectively a passenger for the next week and a half. So my parents still came around to help pack the car, but what they found was effectively a 29-year-old without any capacity to look after themselves. So yeah, basically, my mum, who at the time had just finished a career in relationship psychotherapy, luckily recognised that a sobbing 29-year-old probably wasn't the archetype that she had in her head for where her son was. And then I spent effectively the next week on their couch. Couldn't self-care. Had to be fed by my mother. I don't really remember any explicit emotion. Just dead. There's nothing. Dead, empty the tank, fuzzy brain. But effectively the two things that came out that time was the sound of the dishwasher, and toast with butter is now a comfort food. So that was like the meal that was made for me. And then my mother arranged a mental health geared hospital in North London, where I spent 2 weeks doing 9 to 5 o'clock group and individual therapy. Yeah, when you go back to like the listing of achievements, if you're in that mindset of the way to achieve happiness is through tick boxing and achievements and getting a doctorate, having a son, buying a house, like tick, 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 tick. And so we're in one of the first group therapies, we were all told to how we're doing today, and we were given the feelings wheel, which I highly recommend Googling, 78 emotions to describe how you're feeling. And the one I picked out was, I'm confused. Like, why am I here? I shouldn't be here. I've gone crazy. And luckily I took my academic and learning mindset and jumped into it entirely. And the two things that stuck out was effectively the feeling of failure, fear of failure. So staking happiness on achieving goals, being completely outcome focused and not understanding why those goals are important, and imposing outcomes and being goal focused and milestones onto a 5-month-old, like you said, Lucy, where we actually just keep them alive, that's good enough. Another little bit that took me out was each day I was tasked with reflecting on emotions, so how I felt that day. So I have a large ring binder that I've still got where there's just a diary of reflective thoughts. Yeah, the whole experience, sort of that 2-week intense therapy with another 2 or 3 months of outpatient work, really gave me an education and the tools and the lessons for how to address my emotions and help others as well going forward.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear actually how it sounds like, you know, you're very goal orientated and you throw yourself into education. And so being taken into an environment where then you have slightly more control over your emotions because you're being told how to manage them, what to do, how to improve, you know, your mindset, is probably a really good method that worked for you at the time because of what you'd done previously and what you thought, you know, would work, because you could throw yourself in and be like, well, I'm gonna do this today and learn about this. It's amazing to hear what can be achieved in, you know, in reality 2 weeks is a short space of time when you think about mental health and the impact it can have. Hannah, does this kind of resonate with you and what you've been through previously in terms of what emotions you felt, how you dealt with depression.
Yeah, a lot of it resonated. I was sat listening to it and I was like, yeah, I know what that's like. And I was having a bit of a restless episode last night, actually. And it wasn't really even for anything bad. Like, something good had happened, but it still just messed up my emotions enough that I couldn't sit still, and I must have paced the downstairs of my house for, like, 20 minutes trying to get the feeling out of me. And I think that's why exercise is always such a good help for people, because it kind of helps get that movement going. But, yeah, there's a couple of points. I think a lot of it... So I've had very similar experience to Frederick in the sense that my life was based on achievements, and I felt like I needed to hit certain achievements in order to be successful and not a failure. And I think a lot of that is down to the conditioning you get when you're quite young. And I did a webinar yesterday with some young people, and it was really interesting because all of them were like, you know, the breakdown happened because they were stressed about what they were going to do for the rest of their life. And we were discussing how up until the age of 18, at school, you have to ask to go to the bathroom, but you're also being asked to make a decision on what you want to do for the rest of your life. And it's completely backwards and weird that you're given control of one and not control of the other. And it's this idea that you feel like you have to have made this decision on what your success steps are going to be. And so I think it's actually quite common for quite a lot of people between the ages of like 20 and 30 is you're actually starting to try out things in your career and look at what you're doing and to be like, is this what I want? Am I, you know, a lot of people don't ask themselves if they're doing it because they want to or if they're doing it because they feel they should. Mm. And there's like a really key difference. And I think for a lot of people, knowing the why behind your success steps is really important. And I think if anyone's like looking to help anyone is and they're feeling stressed about things, it's reminding them why they're doing it. So like in Frederick's case, like it was really important for him to be a really great dad. And that, you know, and it's why you're doing it. I find that can actually be quite like a helpful and calming, calming moment. But I also think, I mean, we've touched on this already, like there's just not the same respect for dads in the workplaces as necessarily as mums. I think where, like Lucy was saying, you've got that 1950s like style where people are, you know, they kind of expect the woman to be at home. So when it's the other way around, I think a lot of people don't really know how to deal with it. Not much is spoken about in how it affects men, and I think that's something that needs to happen more. The newest LinkedIn changemaker for parents through this new LinkedIn campaign is actually a man, to make the point that it isn't spoken about enough, which I think is amazing. And also following on, there's a really interesting advert that came out a while back. I don't know if anyone remembers it, but they did job interviews and they turned parenting roles into like official corporate speak, and people were like, yeah, I'd love to do this job. And they said, do you want to talk about money? And these people were like, yep. And they're like, you've got to do it for free. And they were like, yeah, no, I don't want the job. And they were like, well, this is what being a parent's like. This is what your parents do for you every day on top of whatever paid work they are. And I just think it really helped resonate the stress that comes with parenting and the side of it that isn't spoken about. And there's no conversation around how much effort it is.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Frederick, what's your view on the... I guess, support that you had as a dad in the workplace? Do you think there was a lot, there was a little? Was there anything that particularly you found helpful, or was it kind of being thrown into it blind and you were just kind of scrabbling around, you're trying to keep this child alive, as Lucy said?
In my previous workplace, though, there were a lot of things available with hindsight, which I didn't access because in my head I had this model of what I should do and what my wife was doing. Effectively followed that pattern. I'd meet up with for friends, they'd enjoy it. I'd meet up say with my mum once a week, friends once a week. But I think there is a lot of support out there, like from like male to male. It's just it's not tapped. So when I came back to work after depression, told HR, progressively told line management, then told effectively commission management or project directors, and invariably 80-90% of the people I spoke to were male because it's engineering consultancy. They would tell me stories of their own experience or an equivalent experience that they had under a stressful situation, and they had had a breakdown. And around the time I came back, which was late 2017, that the mental health narrative really, I don't think, had really got going. It just felt like the male side of the narrative hadn't really been explored, And just going back onto what Lucy and Hannah mentioned around all these expectations and the changing models of like family relationships, like Lucy was saying, it's incredibly difficult, even with the old model, that you need your support networks. You need a mother or a daycare, or you've had the training and the models that have passed down from your parents. So we're completely equitable in all our relationships, like father to son, father to daughter, son to, and mother to son, mother to daughter. If it's completely equitable, we'd still have those challenges, notwithstanding now that effectively my father didn't take shared parental leave, so I have no basis for understanding. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot to be worked through in terms of moving to this new model. I don't think there's a real understanding of how do we get to that point where both parties are comfortable expressing feelings, which is why I think one of the reasons why shared parental leave was never really taken up, because there's no education, there's no previous experience to draw upon.
Yeah, it's a very interesting discussion. It's a very changing model, and I think it will continue to change, especially when working patterns now are changing a lot in terms of working from home more.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope it gives people more flexibility to be able to share those responsibilities, and, you know, where required, things like external help are so helpful when you're both working full time, and absolutely required. And I think people have to be incredibly open-minded to whatever model they choose is the right thing for them, and they can't just say copy a set model which is right for this year or right for this time, as you see through, say, social media or on the news. Yeah, finding the balance that works for you. I'm hoping there'll be more guidance on it as we progress in terms of shared parental leave and things like that becoming more prominent. But then again, it's up to everyone's choice to take that forward to suit their own personal and working lives.
And Hannah, can I just comment on this this kind of search for role models challenge that Frederick was talking about there as well? I think that we are taught to look up a hierarchy for our role models, and also to look for people that are very similar to us for our role models. So actually, you know, you don't have to look to a dad for a model of what a good dad or a good parent can look like. You can look to a mother, you know, as a dad. And I think also, you know, that hierarchical bit, you know, I look to you guys for inspiration about, you know, things that I can learn with managing my mental health. You know, and some people, I think that might make them feel uncomfortable looking at people that are significantly younger than them for that kind of guidance. But it doesn't. I've kind of pushed through that, you know. So it's this, in the search for role models, we need to be more flexible as to what is our definition of expert. And it's got to be from their lived experience rather than their position in the hierarchy or their similarity to us.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. Role models can and should be found everywhere. Circling back round to think about, I guess, the depressive episode and how you built yourself back up again, what were the key things that really started to drive you to a more positive mindset, help build yourself back up? And what were the sort of most valuable lessons that you learned throughout that process? And also then your support network around you, how that helped you recover?
So drawing on the point that Lucy's just made about role models and people having similar experiences, I think the linchpin of how I've sort of got back is that acknowledging that people have had similar experiences and sharing the information with them, much like our talking therapies. One thing I still use is that feelings wheel, using those 70 different adjectives. And if you share honestly, then you feel better in yourself, and acknowledging that about how we feel is also really important as well. So that we need to be happy all the time is just a fallacy. You're allowed to have different emotions at different points in time. And I think one of the reasons why this period might be challenging is we're built on anticipation. We're brought up that effectively there's a start, and an end. And especially in this period, there is no end. When are we all going to go back to work? When's the new normal going to happen? If we don't appreciate how we are feeling ourselves, then we can just spiral out of control into that negative rumination. Sort of the second point would be knowing and having those support networks. So all the change that happened in the last 5 years leading up to that episode was that I never really spoke to anyone about how I felt. It was all about I did this, I did that, like the achievement outcomes focused background. So having those one-to-one connections are really important to generate that empathy. I've seen that recently with all this remote working, is that loads of people started having Zoom calls, multiple 10, 20 people on a Zoom call trying to have a group dialogue, trying to have a social discussion. It's where you go back to like that one-to-one relationship. You don't generate that kind of connection when the group call. You need that one-to-one connection so you can have that sympathetic dialogue. I think the biggest one was exercise. So looking around after I just got out of hospital, what should I do with my life? These spare hours that I have in my time, I'll look up a local running club. And exercise is just really great. Like there's no real downsides to getting out, enjoying the sunshine. And I think that exercise is one of those mechanisms where it's either a problem, you either have a problem coping mechanism or an emotional coping mechanism. And like, I was so problem focused. Like, I know I'll solve the problem of my son waking up at night by doing X, Y, Z. And if that doesn't solve it, I'll do it like this. And just keep going through and trying to solve the problem. Or emotional coping, where effectively we're just going to change the way we look at the problem. So do it by meditation, so we're not more calm about, or food, alcohol, drinking, all these things that you're doing, the problem actually hasn't gone away. And run, like exercise and running in particular for me sorts both of those things out. So the emotional impact of going out and doing exercise and completing, feeling like that we're blowing off steam, is great as well. That's one extreme. Going outside and going for a walk for 10, 15 minutes just to get outside is as beneficial.
Yeah, no, so, I could not agree more with all of those points. I think the point you make about one-to-one connections, as human beings, the one-to-one connection is really important because that gives us a sense of belonging. And then we can show kindness to one another through those one-to-one connections, which is more difficult to do in a group environment because you don't really get the same depth of connection. So that really resonates with me. Lucy, from your experience, and I know you've mentioned on a previous podcast we've done about coming out of a breakdown, do these points resonate with you on how you built yourself back up again?
Yeah, so when I was coming out of breakdown, one of the key steps to kind of getting signed off by care in the community was something they called a wellness action plan. So it sounds like a cheerful document, but you don't have happy memories of it necessarily as a recovered person, because it asks you to kind of map out how you got into the hole, how you got out of it, and what you learned from the experience. So it's like it's a trigger point in future for if you're getting close to it, you might step in and do some of the actions that I think from what Frederick's recounting there, you know, those triggers, looking back, he knows that they were there, but, you know, he knows very much that, you know, the moment was missed. So all those points on kind of talking to people, getting support, they really resonate with me because that's what's written in mine. But the main one being what you said about, you know, acknowledging how we feel. So I certainly take time to acknowledge not just the kind of the feelings, but how they manifest themselves, like sleep disturbance that we've covered a few times, but also the low appetite. And just point out to my husband, you know, I'm not sleeping well, I don't feel like eating. You know, he knows that when I say that, it's like a, right, okay, here's a pressure point, and, you know, can we do something about it? If he's ever going to kind of step in and help, then that's me putting the flag up. I think the second thing is, when I heard you say your experience of not eating or drinking, I mean, I can feel myself welling up now. It really upset me because I think for us kind of highly driven people that might never dream of kind of, you know, doing anything drastic, as in like an action to end it all, not eating is the long, slow way of ending the misery. So I certainly, when I went through my breakdown, I gave up eating. And I told the psychiatrist as such, you know, when they said, well, would you ever end it all? You know, no, but I'll just stop eating and that'll bring it to a head. So I think it's vitally important that we watch that in ourselves and we watch out for it in others as a sign of not wanting to go on, you know. And bringing that back to parenting, you know, it's a really key thing to watch out for in young people. I must have ate about 5% of my usual calories after I had my first, you know, teenage breakup, and that went on for weeks, and it can really do serious damage if somebody doesn't intervene. But similarly, in this whole being a parent model, you know, don't cook the goat curry for your 6-month-old. You know, you need to cook whatever it is and, you know, feed it to yourself, because I see so many parents that kind of are so concentrated on the whole weaning aspect, you know, and then actually forget to have eaten anything for themselves for, you know, for hours, and, you know, that's so bad for you. So that whole kind of being, acknowledging how you're feeling and acknowledging the, you know, the crucial nourishment for your body is nourishing for the mind as well, is really important for me.
Yeah, some really good points there. I think one thing we haven't really touched upon actually is, from a mental health perspective, you get other issues such as anorexia and bulimia that we've not spoken about previously. But, you know, nourishment is so important to our bodies and our minds, just like you said. And, you know, being able to eat healthily and in a normal routine is so important for us. Hannah, from your perspective as well, what's coming out here in terms of themes that recurrent to you in terms of building yourself back up again and getting out through the other side?
It's interesting, actually, because food is a really big one for me as well. So I used to not eat all day. When my depression was really bad, I physically couldn't leave my room for about 3 weeks. I was at university. And I used to not eat because I couldn't face the idea of having to see or interact with other people in my house. So I wouldn't eat all day, and then I'd order a takeaway to arrive at like 2 o'clock in the morning or something. And then just, and order so much food and just binge eat for the whole day. But it was one of those things where I didn't realise how much of a problem the food was, because I was so focused on the interaction with other people side. And there's actually there's a whole science behind your gut and all of the food that you have in it, and it's linked to how your brain operates. Because one of my conditions is also absolutely horrendous anxiety, and there are so many links, and it's actually really interesting how much food changes. But yeah, one of my main learning points was also about feelings, and the way I try and describe it to other people is, as humans, we've evolved so much, and there are so many parts of our body that we don't have anymore or have changed to fit modern life. But one thing that hasn't changed is your feelings. They are there because they're something that you need to pay attention to. They haven't gone away because they're such a vital part of being alive and being a really successful human. And I think being able to take it down and consider what it is you're feeling will help you understand what it is you need to do, because I think your body does tell you what you need, and you just have to be able to sit and pay attention to it. And I think with the way our busy lives are, it can be really hard to take that time to sit and be like, I just need to concentrate on myself for a little while. And that was the hard learning lesson for me, and it took me years, and I'm still learning how to do that. And I think the final point is your support network, which I know we've discussed already, but the people around you are vital. And I think it's really important for people to sit and take stock on who they are, who is making you feel better, but also who is maybe making you feel worse, and considering their aspect in your life. Because there's so many people that I had in my life that I didn't realize were having a really detrimental effect to me. And it took a lot of guts for me to turn around and be like, okay, I actually need to stop interacting with this person. But I think it works both ways. And when I made that change to remove those people, or at least distance myself from those people and the way I interacted with them, it really helped me look after myself and move into a more positive space.
Yeah, support networks come up again and again throughout all the discussions that we have around mental health, and finding the right support network for you, whoever that may be. You know, that's friends, that's family, that's work colleagues, You can find that anywhere. And also it's about developing that network over time and sharing things with people when you feel comfortable to, so that they can support you in the right way. So lastly, I know, Frederick, you briefly touched upon sort of exercise and running and the benefits of that. So that really interests me. I'm really sporty. I play hockey. I go running quite regularly. Love just going out for a walk. Love being outside with nature, which at the moment with this weather is incredible. I'm loving it. I'd actually just like to ask you, how you were you into running already, or was running something you got into as the, you know, you found it helped you and you're like, yeah, I'm going to commit to getting really good at this, and you know, there you are now doing ultra marathons around the world.
I guess one, going back to anticipation, so my sister, as part of like, I guess, reconnecting, said, oh, I'm doing a half marathon in a few months. I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then my work colleague says, we're doing a marathon in those amount of months. So I was like, well, actually, that sounds like a good structure to get back. And obviously, that's a, looking back, that's a warning sign. All you've done is just transferred from a son, like looking after your son, to, I know, you do a half marathon, and therefore it's this training program. You do a marathon, and therefore it's this training program. But you get like, I got the, effectively the structure of the sessions and then all the friends now that I have from that running club. But for me personally, the why came really, has only really came in the middle of last year. Why am I actually running? And so moving away from, I'm not running to run a marathon, I'm not running to run a half marathon. I'm running because when I run around Box Hill, or I run around Putney Heath, or when I run around Wimbledon Common or Richmond Park, as I pass the deer, the wildlife, listening to the bird song, that's actually really beautiful and really enjoyable. My old self, or let's say me 5-10 years ago, would not have thought about that. When I was doing rowing a lot or weightlifting a lot, it was head down, get on with it, put your body through this, the end. And so now, having had this experience, it's almost a gift, I'd say. It's a really big silver lining that I can take that experience and apply it, help others, like being a mental health champion in my own running club, and saying it's okay to talk, it's okay to feel these things, let's connect.
That's amazing. And I love the fact you mentioned the why behind it, because earlier on, Hannah mentioned you got to find the why behind your success steps, and you know why you're doing certain things. And from going out and running, it didn't immediately come to you why you were necessarily doing it, but eventually when you find that why, it's so powerful and you feel so great about why you're getting out there, why it makes you feel good, how it does make you feel, that in itself is a healing power, really. It's really interesting to hear about that.
Just on exercise, it's interesting because I did the same thing as I was coming out and finishing up therapy and stuff, where I started going to the gym in like an insane amount of times a week, and I'd got my weight and I'd got in really good shape, and like I was really healthy, it wasn't like a problem, but I was doing it again, I think, because you wanted the structure. And it wasn't until recently, like even like during this time now, where you are limited in what you can actually go and do, that you kind of realize that why you were doing it. And for me, it's breathing. I think people undervalue how much breathing can change you and how much your body really needs you to take proper, deep, big breaths and fill yourself with oxygen. So for me, I'm in the Surrey Hills, so I know you love your running routes. So we do those as walks. We do go and do really big walks. For me, it's just so that I can get out and breathe fresh air. I've started doing more yoga because, again, it's focused on the breathing. Like, I never used to really enjoy yoga because I just was like, oh, I'm not moving enough, it's not enough of a workout. But actually the value in it is controlling my breath, and I feel amazing. Like, it's completely, like, understanding why it was important has completely changed how I go about it, and it's now so much more enjoyable as well.
And I think for me, Hannah, it's that what Frederick said there about, you know, realising that it's a gift. So I think, you know, from this experience, I will surpass previous successes and I will enjoy those successes because of this, you know, and I would not be without my experiences, as painful as they are. And I think that resonates a lot with the people that, you know, we'll talk to on other podcasts. You know, you wouldn't be without the experience for what it gives you, even though, you know, you would be without the pain that you've gone through when it's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really kind of valuable advice. So thank you so much for joining us today, Frederick. That was a really great discussion, very interesting points. And I just like kind of my key takeaways from that really were about not putting too much pressure on yourself to be perfect. You know, there is really, perfection is not important in the grand scheme of your whole life and putting things in perspective. Always share your experiences with other people that you feel happy to share experiences with. Most of those will be within a support network that you have for yourself. And the power of finding something that can really give you a why, and in this case it was running, it can be anything from walking to baking to sewing to, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of other hobbies out there. That really resonated with me as well. So yeah, thank you for joining. And to all our listeners out there, if you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review and subscribe. And if you have any comments or feedback, you can email us at constructingmindsets@gmail.com. So thank you very much for listening.